This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Smart Card World. We're about to speak to Randy Vanderhoof, who's the executive director of the Smart Card Alliance based in New Jersey. Welcome back to Utopia Media's Smart Card World.
Thanks, Mark. How are you today?
I'm good. Before we get into the details of the fifth annual Smart Cards in Government Conference that we're going to talk about, remind our listeners what Smart Card Alliance is, and while you're doing that, give new people the briefest introduction to what exactly a smart card itself is.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the Smart Card Alliance is an industry association. We represent the smart card technology that's used in North America as well as Latin America, and some of our members include leading financial institutions, leading security contractors, manufacturers of security systems and IT computing networks.
So it's pretty much soup to nuts. People can get from your members everything they need to implement a smart card program.
Yes, absolutely. Our organization, you know, represents all of the leading providers of the technology. And smart cards, which is not necessarily a common word in everyone's vocabulary, is a microcomputer-based chip that is installed into a card or some type of small carrying device.
Could be a flash drive or a wand or something.
Yeah, the USB devices, serial devices, as well as standalone devices, and now we're seeing them in things like identification cards and credit cards and cell phones and all kinds of new and interesting implementations of the technology.
Okay, so that's the background. The fifth annual Smart Cards and Government Conference is going to be held April 18th to 20th, 2006, at the Sheraton National Hotel in Arlington, Virginia. Who are you expecting will attend this event?
This event has really been growing rapidly in the last few years, Mark, primarily because smart cards is also become a very important part of the federal government's move towards increasing security and streamlining government services. A few years back, the President Bush signed something called the Homeland Security Presidential Directive Number 12, which required all federal government agencies to come up with a uniform identity credential that could be tamper-proof and provide for an interoperable way for government employees to access their facilities as well as other federal government agencies.
And when was that directive issued?
It was issued in August of 2004.
Okay, and did that intend that this document should work both for physical access and online access?
Exactly. It's part of an overall e-government initiative for secure access to government network services and websites, as well as a secure identity credential for people to get in and out of secure buildings.
Now, how far along is the government's process of developing the standards for that card or that program?
The federal government set very tight timelines to be in compliance with this presidential directive. The first step they did was to empower the Department of Commerce, National Institute of Standards and Technology, to develop a specification for interoperability. That specification was published last March, and since then, the industry has been working rapidly on developing compliant technology to meet the new federal government industry standards.
So there are standards in place that NIST developed, and all government cards need to meet those standards.
That's absolutely correct. And the deadline for issuing new identity credentials with this new smart card-enabled technology is October of 2006 for any new employees and October of 2007 for all federal employees. So there's really a lot of work to be done.
And can you give an estimate of how many cards need to be replaced and how many new ones produced under this directive?
Figures vary because the regulation not only covers federal government employees, but also federal contractors working under federal agencies. And as you know, many of our federal government work is done by outside contractors working under these types of shared services agreements. So the numbers have been estimated between 5 million up to 10 million identity credentials that are going to need to be replaced.
Okay, now did this directive or related orders specify a regime for the certification of the data that's included, or the vetting of the cardholders, or did it just refer to the use of smart cards within the cards themselves?
NIST has done a very comprehensive job in trying to define these requirements. So they have they have defined what the card file should look like that's stored on the card that identifies each individual unique employee or government contractor that holds one of these cards, as well as the interfaces to the card for door access readers or network computing systems to access the secure information that's inside the chip.
But the standard doesn't address issues of how you determine the accuracy of the data that's included within these protocols.
Well, there are very strict guidelines for how the cards are actually going to be issued.
So okay.
There's a whole identity proofing process
right.
that goes on before the cards are ever issued that require background checks and verification of source documents before an identity credential can be issued. So therefore, if the work is done up front to make sure that individuals are properly vetted, and then the procedures are followed according to the guidelines for how a person is identified using their biometric information, their information from their human resource files, and other application file information they provide, it's a very secure way in which federal government employees can be identified in the system.
Because obviously a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, and these cards are, in some sense, the keys to the big and little kingdoms, and it's important that the data that and the basis on which they're issued has been checked and rechecked beforehand.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the risks that the government undertook when they began this initiative is by coming up with this requirement, it raised the bar for all agencies to make sure that their houses are in order, that they're properly documented, all of their employees, and that the people that are walking around Washington and other places around the country and the world with a federal government ID actually belongs to that individual, and that person has a lawful right to own it.
So smart cards are really at the crux of an entire network of credentialing, vetting, and security calculations.
Well, it's really a foundation for security, because without being able to trust who the individual is, when you don't know that person or have had no prior contact or relationship with them, is really essential to whether or not your system can feel secure. And in an electronic world where we're constantly working over the internet or in remote locations and needing to access secure information or secure facilities, it's becoming increasingly important that we have some way of trusting who the individuals are. And smart card technology becomes a flexible, portable platform that makes that whole system possible.
Are these standards open source, proprietary, confidential, or in other words, how carefully guarded is the technology for purposes of preventing counterfeiting?
All of the information regarding the specifications are open and published by NIST on their website. The actual responsibility for securing that information falls on the government agencies themselves, and they've been given strict guidelines for how to capture this information, how to protect it securely, and also how to manage it properly.
And, of course, this part of the essence of the smart card is its ability to maintain the security on itself of the data that it's holding.
And exactly. You know, the fact that a smart card can be changed after it's been issued is a really important fundamental capability that they offer. So if someone was issued an ID credential and 6 months later that individual leaves the organization, there must be a way to electronically disable that card so that it can't continue to carry its same access rights and privileges that it did when it was first issued.
Or conversely, if their privileges are increased or changed.
Exactly. We're always finding that people get new responsibilities or change locations where they work, or have gotten higher levels of clearances, which require additional identification information.
Now, in part, is that handled through the issuance of digital certificates? And maybe you could tell us what those are and how that relates to a PKI or a public key infrastructure, and how that's useful in upgrading or degrading the security level of any particular cardholder.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, a digital certificate in the simplest terms is a numerical value or data field that's been assigned by what we call a trusted third party or someone that is going to back the identity of the individual. So that numerical value is assigned to an individual and loaded onto their ID credential. And whenever that ID credential is presented, that digital certificate that's stored inside that smart card is used to validate against a list of valid individuals.
Which can be updated instantaneously if a person has increased rights or decreased rights.
Yes, or if that credential is revoked, then there's a revocation list or a list of digital certificates that are no longer valid. And again, these are automatically updated in the PKI systems, which use to validate individuals logging into secure networks.
It's essentially if you present your credit card and it's overdrawn and they cut it in half and hand it back to you.
Yes, and your account number that's in the system that could be used remotely or through a keyboard is also disabled at the same time.
Okay. More specifically, what are the kinds of cards or applications that the smart cards are going to be put to use for according to the NIST standards and according to the directive that we've talked about?
The two primary uses are going to be for physical access security as well as access to secure computer networks within the agencies. But smart cards don't end there, because some of the other applications that are happening around the world with smart cards are for financial payments, for transportation systems, use in mobile phones for data storage and security. And many of these applications are being looked at as additional capabilities that could be piggybacked onto the new federal identity card.
Because they're programmable and they have a certain amount of storage capacity.
Exactly. And in the case of Washington, D.C., where a large number of our federal employees work, the Washington Metro Area Transit System runs on a smart card. So the capability of getting to work and getting in the building using the same ID is a very attractive model, not only for the individuals, but as well as the federal agencies.
Is the situation now that a person would have multiple smart cards?
Yes, today those systems operate on separate platforms using separate cards and separate systems to operate. But the electronic compatibility of these systems are getting closer and closer all the time.
And there's no reason, for example, why the Metro couldn't adopt the government standard for its cards, is there?
That work is an ongoing process, and we would expect that there will be a convergence between the transportation systems and the identity systems in the very near future.
And what about driver's licenses from Virginia or Maryland or from the district? Could those be piggybacked onto these cards as well?
Yes, there's no restrictions to stop that from happening. You know, one of the things that are currently being debated in Congress right now is something called the Real ID Act,
which right.
is a legislation to require states to come up with a uniform driver's license standard so that they can be validated and trusted across the country.
And one provision of that is that there be a uniformly readable, a machine-readable format on those cards.
Yes, we have to move beyond what the visual authenticity of the identity credential is, and we have to move to more secure means where we can actually use a machine or a system to validate that that credential is still current and that it's not been tampered with.
Now, is your group working to see that the general terms of the Real ID Act be implemented through the use of smart cards to meet that common machine-readable standard?
We're an educational resource, and our members in our organization believe that smart card technology has a role to play in all identity credentials, including driver's licenses. We're not a lobbying group, so we're not here trying to sway legislators or the Department of Homeland Security to select our technology over any others, but we really feel we have a position to represent the technology and explain the benefits and let the value of it stand up against all the other technology options that are out there.
Okay. Well, no, when we talk about a government cards. Are we talking about cards issued by government only to government workers, or cards issued by government to civilians, such as driver's licenses? Is there a distinction? Will there be a distinction at the Smart Cards in Government 2006 conference in April along those two lines, or are they kind of blended at this point?
No, I think there's valid reasons to distinguish the differences, because there are unique requirements in the public identity credentials that differ from the employee identity credentials.
Could you briefly distinguish the two classes?
Well, primarily the difference is the means by which employees gain access to buildings utilizes a radio frequency communication between the ID card and the reader in order to get people through doors quickly and efficiently.
This is RFID or contactless smart cards?
Contactless smart card technology, which uses RF technology as its means of communication.
Could you distinguish, because we're going to talk about it a little bit later, the difference between a contactless smart card and an RFID card? Or a card with RFID on it?
Sure. A contactless smart card has RF capability, but is wrapped around a secure microprocessor with its security functionality built into it. RFID technology, which is commonly used to track packages and shipments from location to location, uses radio waves to communicate a static identity code, and just about any reader or any device that is in the area will be able to read that information.
Is there much of a cost differential between RFID on a card and a contactless smart card?
Yeah, typically the cost is significantly lower for RFID technology, which is engineered to be as low cost as possible with the highest distance of readability, whereby contactless smart cards are built to be secure with a very narrow read range so that information off of a secure smart card can only be read by the proper authority.
And with the connivance of the holder in most cases, is that right?
Absolutely. We want to protect the personal information of an individual when they're carrying a secure ID card so that it's only accessible in places and systems where both the user is aware of it and it's been already pre-approved and accessible.
Okay. No unknown snooping can be done with contactless smart cards.
Contactless smart cards offers a number of security measures and countermeasures to prevent unauthorized snooping. And really, the combination of the capabilities of the contactless interface, as well as the way the personal information is secured and protected inside the security of the smart chip, really makes that that capability a very good use for securing a person's identity.
Okay. Speak briefly about who's going to be speaking, what the program is going to be at this Smart Cards in Government 2006 conference.
We have a mix of government speakers as well as industry speakers and outside analysts that are going to be presenting on these topics. Because this topic is pervasive across a number of different parts of the government, we are going to be focusing only a portion of our program agenda on the HSP D12 initiative, and we'll be also then bringing individuals up to speed in what's happening in the area of driver's licenses, electronic passports, which will begin to be issued this year that have smart cards in them, also the new registered traveler program that's coming up, and some of the public policy and legislative issues that are starting to happen around the country.
That program you mentioned first, what is that exactly?
The electronic passport?
No, with the set of letters and the numbers that I didn't recognize. The first...
HSPD-12.
Yes, what is that?
That's the Homeland Security Presidential Directive.
Oh, okay.
12 that I mentioned.
That we've been talking about. But
with the federal identity card.
Right.
Mandate, yes.
Okay. Briefly talk about the... You mentioned in the program notes that there are opportunities and challenges that the government has to deal with, and that government issuers, accreditation and testing authorities, procurement programs, and the industry have to deal with. What are some of those major opportunities and challenges for each of those groups?
Well, anytime a new industry standard is defined, it has a ripple effect throughout the entire infrastructure of systems that are already in place or that are looking to implement the ID cards with the new standard. The data file structure is different. The security measures are different. The interfaces between the back-end systems has to be upgraded in order to be able to read the new ID. These are not insignificant development projects. That industry has been working very closely with the standards people and its own internal development groups to try to come up with products and solutions that will be available to the government customer in the timelines that they need in order to meet their obligations. However, this process must go through conformance testing that is being set up by NIST currently. There's also some performance testing that's being defined by the GSA before products can be put on the federal schedule for agencies to be able to purchase them without going out to bid. All of these steps in the procurement process and development process need to be coordinated between the various aspects of the technology, the readers, and the systems that are going to be implemented by this. And therefore, it's created a number of challenges that are not easy to be overcome, but are certainly require a high level of coordination between the government and industry.
It seems like this directive has, in fact, jumped the whole smart card business to a higher level with all of this activity, hasn't it?
It has fast-tracked an interoperability specification that didn't exist anywhere in the world. And really, the U.S. Government effort in this area is helping to pave the way for an international standard for how identity credentials are created, issued, and managed in order to maintain open standards and interoperability. And therefore, the European Union, the Asia-Pacific organizations are all looking at and working with the standards people in the U.S. to try to come up with a new ISO standard, which is the international standards body, to develop a common platform for all identity credentials.
And so this project has essentially given the U.S. a step ahead in the process of forming that international standard, advantage the U.S. standard globally.
The U.S. has by far, is far ahead of the other standards bodies and therefore are taking a leadership position to bring the rest of the world market on board with these types of standards. And this is really going to be essential in the global economy where people are going to be traveling in and out of airports and businesses around the world, and people need to know that they have a way of positively identifying themselves in a system that they may not have ever interfaced with before.
Okay. How much of the, if you can talk about this, how much of the smart card industry's business does go to government currently? Or comes from government currently?
Actually, it's a fairly small percentage. I think estimates in the U.S. market is under 10%.
Okay.
A majority of the business for smart cards in the United States is being driven by the advent of contactless payments in the payments industry, as well as in the commercial side of physical security, coming up with new smart card-enabled ID badges for physical and logical access.
Okay, we're talking about the government conference, but briefly talk about the rollout of these contactless payment cards and whether all of this development for the government standard has any impact on that contactless payment space, or whether they're pretty independent.
Well, probably most people have seen the MasterCard advertisements for PayPass and talking about the use of credit cards in drive-up windows at fast food restaurants and convenience stores and such. This is part of a revolution that's happening in the payments industry to have credit cards be accepted in what we call quick service retail environments. And these new credit cards are being built using smart card technology with a contactless interface, much the same as the technology that's being used in these identity credentials. So what's common is that they're using the same industry standard, the same chips and security measures that are going into the federal government ID cards are also being used in the payments industry. So what we're seeing is a maturing of the marketplace across many different vertical markets, and this is going to drop costs, increase the number of options, and rapidly move innovation forward.
So essentially, people could buy their coffee at a convenience store and use it on the metro and use it to get into the building and use it to get into the network.
Exactly. It's trying to bring more convenience to the consumer who doesn't have to carry cash or checks to make small purchases. It also provides benefits to the merchants because they can process people faster with this technology than they can by accepting cash or traditional credit cards. So there's a benefit both from the consumer side as well as from the merchant side. And banks get a big benefit because people are using their bank-issued card more frequently than they ever did before.
Okay. I wanted to take a particular case and have you talk about how smart cards might be used there. There's a lot of debate back and forth about whether there should be a guest worker program that would allow non-U.S. citizens to come into the U.S. and work and go back or stay under certain conditions and terms and so on. Is there specifically already any discussion within the discussion about that kind of immigration policy about the use of smart card technology as a way of facilitating that? And does the technology in a certain sense at a certain level drive the discussion, or is it the other way around, or is there an interplay about the technology and the policies that are being pursued? And do you think the policymakers are sufficiently aware of the opportunities through the technology to help them in formulating their policies?
If the decision makers are not aware, they will be aware soon. This is not a new technology. So the technology has been around for over 20 years now. It's just really beginning to take hold in the United States. Our federal government has been at the center of a lot of discussions in terms of how to come up with new secure travel documents in terms of passports and visas, how to read that information at the border, and how to do so in a way that increases security but doesn't slow down the process. And certainly, smart card technology has a place in that space, and we expect that it's going to play an important role in that in the future as these systems start to roll out.
And in fact, that ties in with what you were talking about the use of the standard that's being developed here for U.S. government purposes internationally, say for neighbors of the United States. Their government can adopt it and credential their own citizens and then have that process involve linkage through databases of everyone involved.
Correct. I mean, the advantage that having the information secured on your border card or your identity card is that it transcends any language barriers or educational barriers. It gives the cardholder the confidence to know that they're not going to have to do anything more to prove their identity other than present their card and possibly their finger for a biometric match of the information on the card, and then they're through and off doing their work or doing their business that they need to do to cross the border. So it provides a tremendous economic boost because it streamlines the process of getting individuals in and out of the border points, as well as provides for a much more robust security platform so that individuals who are trying to compromise the system or come up with false credentials to get in will be stopped at the border.
So, in fact, some of the advantages are comparable, although different in kind, from what we were talking about at a convenience store. There are advantages for the user, there are advantages for the point of contact, there are advantages for networks that are connected to that in terms of efficiency and security.
Yes, and everyone benefits when there's more security without increasing the time it takes to get people to and from their business.
And essentially making the transactions faster and more secure.
Exactly.
Okay. Legislation is still pending in the California legislature that would establish a 3-year moratorium on the use of RFID on or in any government-issued state ID document from library cards to driver's licenses. Are you aware of any similar efforts in other states?
We're starting to hear from other states of introducing similar legislation in the interest of individual privacy and security. But so far, California has been the one that has gotten the most attention.
Okay, now we alluded to this earlier. I did a lot of coverage of this RFID story. I interviewed the principal author a few times, the author of the bill a few times. It seems to me that the use of contactless smart cards would provide the functionality that is sought by the users of these cards while avoiding some of the civil liberties issues that opponents of this RFID on cards has raised. Could you address that again in more detail and talk about whether there might be some way around this problem by adopting a more robust technology rather than a less robust one?
Yeah, essentially the debate is around, can an identity credential, particularly one that utilizes contactless or RF technology, provide a level of privacy and security for the individual and the individual's personal information. And without getting too far into the technology debate, the answer to that question is clearly yes, it can. However, it's a challenge for the legislators to write laws that adequately protect privacy and security without being too broad, so that they cover or outlaw legitimate uses of the technology.
Right.
So our industry and our organization has been trying to educate the lawmakers to understand the differences between insecure RFID technology and secure contactless smart card technology for the use of identity credentials. Once we are able to explain that identity credentials can be issued that are secure, that are privacy sensitive, and that will protect an individual's personal information, then we feel that it won't be necessary to try to legislate this technology out of our environment, but instead to embrace the technology because with it brings so many other added benefits.
As part of the discussion, what do you sense is the public mood about and public knowledge about the trade-offs between security and privacy that are implicit in these discussions?
Unfortunately, the public is being fed a lot of information based on the individual's point of view that is not necessarily representative of the facts. So the consumer or the average customer, when they read about the fact that someone's ID card can be scanned and read from a distance by some unknown person, of course it's going to elicit fears that they're going to be spied upon and their privacy violated.
In a sense, it's a question of framing, whether the question is, do you want security and speed in your transaction or do you want to be snooped on?
But there doesn't need to be a choice between those two. The fact is that with the appropriate technology, you can have both the security as well as the personal privacy that you deserve.
What steps is your group taking or others taking to raise the level of public understanding of these issues?
Well, forums such as our Smart Cards and Government Conference is an opportunity for us to be able to discuss these in an open environment and to share the latest information so people have a better understanding of the differences that are out there in different technologies.
So that conference will be getting a certain amount of coverage, and you're hoping that presenters and spokespeople there will be making that point, as well as others.
And not only this event, but our organization does outreach on a continuous basis, both in the U.S. and around the world. We have speakers that talk at conferences on privacy, on IT security, on education. Regardless of the venue, personal privacy and security is a topic that's relevant. And we send individuals, and myself particularly, I speak at probably 12 to 15 conferences a year, talking about the role that smart card technology can have as an enabler of security without sacrificing privacy.
You're not sending speakers into high schools yet, are you, to have smart card days and explain things to the students there?
No, we're trying to stay more at the decision-maker level, so certainly the policymakers and the individuals who represent the computing environments, the library systems, the IT markets, the physical security markets, the people that are making decisions about how to protect their either employees or their customers, they're the ones that we want to educate so that they make the right decisions when the time comes to improve their systems.
Okay, now it seems from what we've been talking about that people will be using smart cards to buy their coffee, to get into their offices, get into networks and travel and a lot of functions. Is there a movement for or a tendency towards already the universal credentialing of the population and what would be involved in that financially and technically, and maybe we can even talk a little bit about what it means kind of psychologically?
Yeah, the barriers to the uniform ID card or the uniform smart card that does everything for us are primarily at the business level, not at the technology level. So there remains to be resolved who's going to manage the real estate. Much in the way of a tenant-landlord scenario, someone has to be responsible for issuing the card and all of the information and the data on that card.
Well, it sounds like the two main players here are the government and the credit card companies, or the credit card issuers. Is that fair to say?
Well, that's true, but our federal government is very cautious about crossing over into commercial venues,
right?
Outside of the delivery of government services.
Is that some sort of an obstacle for the integration of the contactless payment smart cards and government-issued cards?
Well, it's one of the issues that are being discussed and have not been resolved yet. So, yes, being able to expand the use of the federal government-issued ID card to do non-identity applications such as payments or transportation is going to require another level of communication and cooperation between the different levels of government and commercial industry.
Well, how about letting the commercial industry adopt the government standard and put those pieces of real estate under, if not their jurisdiction, under their administration?
Well, that's certainly another option, and then that raises issues in terms of liability. So if a commercial entity is issuing a card and that card is going to be used for a secure identity credential from a federal employee that is managed by a federal agency, there would be opportunities for who would be responsible for that data and that individual's use of the card.
So it seems from this discussion that what's likely is that most people would have two cards, a contactless payment card issued by a bank and a government ID card issued by a state or the federal government. Is that generally where things are tending then?
Well, we certainly think this is how things are going to roll out initially. And once people realize that they start asking the question, why am I carrying four different smart cards in my wallet, one for payments, one for access, one's for getting on the subway, or one's for paying my parking, they're going to start questioning the vendors of those systems and ask why they can't have everything converged onto one.
Okay.
That's the type of movement that will drive the convergence faster because the consumer will ultimately demand it.
Okay. Now, we haven't been talking a lot about really only in passing, about the use of these cards for access to networks. Could you say a little bit more specifically about what's going to happen as wireless and fiber optic networks emerge and proliferate and establish the opportunity for people to have access to their web files and to their files and computing capacity almost anywhere at any time, and what kind of form factors and procedures are going to be in place for billing and access for people to access the internet through the use of smart cards?
Wow, that was a lot of them one question. Let me start by talking about network access from two different perspectives.
Right.
One is internet banking or internet payments, and that's an area of great concern because as more and more people move to electronic banking or shopping online, the opportunity for fraud also increases, both at the consumer level as well as at the merchant and the bank level. So as fraud continues to grow, there's increasing pressure on issuing banks to come up with more secure ways to protect the networks. One way that they're being driven to is to have what's referred to as a two-factor authentication. Not only my account number, which might be my bank-issued credit card ID, but also having a physical card or token or some other device that I must have present when I make that transaction. When I'm dealing on my home computer, There's no one that can physically see whether or not I have that card present. So the idea is that a card has to be able to be machine read by my computer by having the card inserted into a reader that's connected to my computer to validate that the card is actually present.
Now, as I'm looking at my computer, I don't see any slots here for smart cards, but I do see USB ports.
Correct. USB is going to be the interface of choice for most peripheral devices at the computer level. So there are already smart cards in the form of a USB dongle device that actually can just be inserted right into the USB port, or there are very inexpensive peripheral readers that connect to the PC using the USB interface.
And those are already at a stage where they can be used to certify the person for banking or e-commerce transactions.
Yes, that's correct. Another part of the evolution is also at the operating system level and computing systems. As Windows has moved from its generation 98 to Windows 2000 to XP, they've built more and more of the smart card interface into those operating systems so that now when an individual wants to install a smart card reader that they get from their bank or from some other source, it's a matter of plugging it in just they would plug in an external floppy disk drive or hard drive, where before it required someone to go into your computer, load software, do manual configurations, which was a real barrier to trying to get consumer adoption.
What about using smart cards in the newer and more mobile devices, PDAs, laptops, cell phones? What are the form factors that allow for the integration of the identity protection functions of smart cards into devices like that?
Well, smart card technology has already made its way into cell phones, and it's the cell phones today, particularly from vendors like Singular and T1, have a smart card chip, which is called a SIM module, which is a mini version of a smart card already inside the phone that's used to carry their subscriber information.
Is this like an SD chip?
Well, it's similar in the way it looks and its size, but it's actually different from SD in that it uses a different memory and security than secure data.
And can these SIM chips then be moved from device to device?
Yes, they're 100% portable. In fact, if you own a GSM model phone, the phone becomes a throwaway item. You can take your SIM chip out of one GSM phone and put it into another GSM phone, and that phone then becomes your phone with your list of contacts in it and data information, and it's 100% portable.
Okay, now we're getting towards the end here, but I'd like you to address something pretty specific. We've talked a little bit about the advantages of having universal credentialing. Specifically in California, the governor here has proposed to selling $68 billion in bonds as part of a $222 billion funding for what he characterizes as essential infrastructure spending, which is mostly, from what he's been saying and what the legislators have been saying, intended to be used for roads, bridges, and other pieces of physical equipment. Do you think that smart cards and related technologies might qualify as an essential infrastructure expenditure, along with these roads, bridges, hospitals, and schools, given what we've already talked about in terms of its benefits to individual card users, as well as the networks and institutions that they're affiliated with?
Certainly it could, particularly if you think of in terms of having the smart card technology support the healthcare systems, such as the food stamp programs and WIC programs that are available, carrying personal medical record information, which would streamline cost and delivery of healthcare services, tie it into parking systems and toll systems for transportation, tie it into access to government facilities and services. It could become an important foundation technology that will help enable a lot of the infrastructure or the uses of infrastructure in California and other states to operate more efficiently and to provide more services to the consumers.
In fact, from what you've just given me an idea here, that essentially the smart card program could be tied to the infrastructure, the physical infrastructure program in terms of roads and bridges and toll roads and toll bridges that are around, and that that card once issued for use with the physical infrastructure could obviously be multitasked for other applications.
Yes, and the fact that it comes in so many different shapes and flavors, that smart card capability could reside in your phone, or it could reside in a card in your wallet, or something hanging off of your keychain, or something you mount or store in your car, in your laptop computer, even in your home. So there's no limit to what it can do for you in terms of providing a combination of services, whether it's for access or for making a transaction.
All of which would deliver the benefits that we've talked about to the user and to the network and its operators in many different ways.
Very true.
Thanks very much for talking to us. If people want to get some more information about this conference and possibly register and attend, where can they go on the Internet to get that additional information?
The Smart Card Alliance homepage has links to all of the information, including our upcoming conference on April 18th through the 20th. The web address is www.smartcardalliance.org. And you can also call our 800 number, 800-556-6828, and speak to an individual who can provide you with that information.
Okay, well, thank you for providing us and our listeners with all this information, and I look forward to talking to you more as this process continues to evolve.
Thank you. Thank you very much for talking to me today.
You're welcome. Bye.